Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. We'll begin today's show with an update about the Oakland teacher strike, which ended on Monday. 58% of the Oakland Educators Association members voted to ratify a deal with the district. As the narrow win for the deal shows, many educators continue to have concerns about planned school closures and workloads for school counselors and nurses. Joining us to talk about how the deal will impact educators and staff and the concerns they still have is Alex Webster Guiney. Alex has been a special education teacher with the Unified Oakland School District for 4 years. She was also a teacher in New York City for 4 years. Hi, Alex. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, thank you.
Well, last time we spoke to you, Alex, you joined us from the front lines. You were there picketing. This was a 7-day strike, and it ended on Monday. Did you vote in favor of the deal?
No, I voted no. I was definitely a no.
So first off, before we talk about why you voted against it, what is in the contract?
Well, there's a couple different things. Some of them are student support, specifically for students with IEPs, like hard caps for speech pathologists, class size reductions, caseload reductions, counselor caseload reductions, and a special ed teacher caseload reductions, as well as psychologist caseload reductions. There is also an 11% raise for teachers over 4 years. Those are sort of the broad strokes of what the contract got us.
Can you talk about this raise? I mean, this is really important because as you and other teachers have said, it's so difficult to not only make ends meet, but also pay your rent in the very expensive Bay Area. And, you know, teachers are making $50,000, $60,000. Why is it 11% over 4 years?
I mean, are you asking, like, why did we not get 12 over 3, or...
Why not right now?
The short answer is the district doesn't have the money to give us that much right now.
Right.
Well, it does have the money. It's just not willing to go to lengths to make reductions on its side, you know, on its current budget. So, quote, the money isn't there to give us more right now.
Tell us what else is in this package. According to KTVU, Oakland is still going to slash more than $22 million in the budget. The board voted 4-3 to trim the budget, which did away with restorative justice programs, social services targeted to helping students in foster care, and school service officers. Can you tell us about these cuts?
Yeah, they're pretty much what you said. There's cuts to restorative justice. There's cuts to the PISA program, which is the Asian and Pacific Islander Academic Success Program. There's cuts to the foster youth program. But to be clear, those cuts were in the pipeline before the strike. They were planned before the strike, so it wasn't a result of the contract that these cuts were made.
And Alex, tell us why you voted no on the contract.
Well, a couple reasons. First of all, 11% over 4 years is not the same as 12% over 3 years. It's less than the yearly CPI for the Bay Area, so we still are not getting enough to keep up with the cost of living. And we didn't get a raise for one of the years that we went without a contract. Even though the cost of living went up, we didn't get money for that. Aside from that, the one-time bonus that we got is not enough to cover all the days that we were out on strike. That's the money piece, which, you know, if we really were going to keep up with the cost of living over 4 years, we would have gotten 16% over 4 years. So that didn't happen. And that's the money piece, and that's sort of the part I think that has been the most controversial in terms of, like, dividing, you know, students against teachers or teachers against teachers or, you know, what the bargaining team could have gotten. But more than that, like, the board, you know, they're cutting these positions, like these student supports, they're cutting a bunch of central office positions. They're not cutting salaries of their top-level officials at all, and they're not cutting overtime for non-union positions. For instance, a non-union position that's a payroll accountant whose base salary was $68,000 last year, or actually in 2017, but who made $140 in overtime. So, like, if overtime is not available to union employees, like teachers who work overtime every single day, I think it's not right that overtime is available to other positions, to non-union positions within OUSC. Like, you should just get a salary, just like we do. And you know, the kind of the bloated paychecks of the folks at the top are so out of line with the paychecks of the teachers who work below them. You know, if those positions were brought more into line with the national average in terms of what the superintendent making, or, you know, what are some of the officers making, then, you know, then we would have more money in the budget to think about giving teachers a living wage. So that was sort of the first thing, that the money was disappointing. The second thing that I had a problem with was that, the third thing that I had a problem with is that the school closures, I know that school closures are not actually bargainable by the union, but we're in a position with rank and file, like we could still ask for school closures to stop. And I know that Amy Ng promised a resolution that would stop any school closures for 5 months. That really just puts us at the beginning of next year for more school closures to continue. I think like the whole process of school closures needs to be looked at, and we need to have an open forum with community members and teachers, and you know, lots of oversight for this process. And that moratorium, that 5 month moratorium, doesn't give us any kind of voice. Also, the last salary increase. It's going to be the biggest one, which will happen in 2021, and that's going to put us in a pretty poor bargaining position for the next contract.
So you brought up a number of points here. On the salary, again, that is so important, because if we want teachers to live in the community, they need to be paid a living wage. I was just looking yesterday online. It looks like San Francisco and Oakland, I mean, the one bedrooms are still in the 3,000. So it's incredibly hard to pay that kind of rent on these salaries. How is the union, the Oakland Education Association, which represents 3,000 educators, including teachers, librarians, counselors, nurses, and others, how are they responding to your concerns about salaries?
I think the union acknowledges that, you know, what we're paid is not adequate. And, you know, that was a huge reason that this fight began. And in fact, even the school district acknowledges that teachers aren't paid enough. Mm-hmm. The teacher retention is a huge problem for them. But I think, CTA, the California Teachers Association, was advising the bargaining team, the OEA bargaining team. And they say that, you know, there's three separate analysts who analyze the budget, and the conclusion is the same. The district has no money left. So I think that there is there's sort of this understanding that, like, OUSD is just broke. You know, they did a bad job managing their finances, and now they don't have money for the things that they need. From my position as a rank-and-file teacher, I'm feeling a little bit like, well, they have the money, they're just using it in the wrong ways. You know, the budget is right. There's not a surplus in the budget to raise teacher salaries, but the surplus isn't there because of decisions that they already made about how to use the money.
Right.
So that sort of like the difference between the union's position, which is, yes, there is money, and rank and file or other even more militant teacher's position, which is like, yeah, the money is there, it's just being used in dumb ways.
Today we're speaking with Alex Webster-Guiney. She has been a special education teacher with the Oakland Unified School District for 4 years, and Alex is going to stay with us for five or so more minutes. If you have any questions or comments about this deal in Oakland that was agreed upon by 58% of the Oakland Educators Association members, Alex voted no. She's explaining why. Salary, overtime, bloated paychecks for administrators, school closures, and then just bargaining next time around. What questions do you have about this deal? If you are an Oakland teacher, or if you work in the Oakland School District, we'd love to hear from you. If you have kids in the district, Alex will be with us for about five more minutes. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Alex, you mentioned how administrators are being paid overtime. You say that they have bloated paychecks. How is the union and the district responding to those concerns?
I don't know. To my knowledge, the union hasn't really brought up those concerns with the district, and I don't know if it's just because, you know, our current union officers have really only been in office since October, and you know, they haven't gotten to a point of experience with sort of having their members back them to make these demands, or you know, what it is that's going on there, but. I'm not really sure why that hasn't been part of the bargaining team's agenda.
You also mentioned school closures, and we have a question from Sandy in Oakland, and she says, how is it that when a school is closed, a charter school moves in?
That's a good question. There is a law from 1998 that states that any surplus district properties have to first be offered to charter operators. They have the right of first refusal below market price. So it's a really good opportunity for a charter school to find a place to operate. And since the schools are set up like schools already, the costs for development are, you know, low, and the facilities are there, and so it's kind of a turnkey operation for charter operators.
What about your concerns about bargaining in the future? Can you explain why you're concerned about that?
Yeah, I mean, our last raise, which is the biggest one, which is 3.5%, is supposed to be happening in 2021. And I think that, that's the only raise in this contract that may possibly become close to keeping pace with inflation and the cost of living in the Bay Area. So receiving that raise the last year of the contract and then going into negotiating the next contract saying we want a raise, the optics are going to be sort of like, well, you just got a raise. In fact, you got the biggest raise you've gotten over the last 4 years. Hmm. So it's going to be difficult for us to make a case that we need a raise.
And have you spoken with the union about that concern?
Yeah. The union's statement, well, I don't think they haven't had an official statement, but their explanation at the sort of open forum on Sunday was that the reason that the biggest raise comes last is because the anticipation that there will be money there in 2021 that there just isn't there currently because things are in such a shambles.
Hmm. So where does this go from here, Alex? And also, do you feel like, are you in constant contact with the union? Is there a line of communication happening between educators and the union?
To your second question, I think that in the future, the union and the members need to be in better contact. I think because this is the first rodeo for these folks, that they didn't really have a sense necessarily of how strong the members were feeling on the lines. Like, I think that a lot of members could have, you know, gone on with the strike for a longer amount of time, but I think the union was getting nervous that they were going to have people starting to cross the line if the strike went any longer. So I want to make sure that there is more transparency, is the wrong word, but just like more communication, more chances for the union officers to hear from rank and file, to hear from their members, and not just through like through their reps, but actually like in an open forum where there's like questions and answers that could be had. As far as where we go from here, I think there's a lot of local actions that need to happen. For instance, flipping the board, that's going to be a big push for Oakland teachers in 2020 when the next elections happen. We're feeling pretty much like the board members are not doing a great job for Oakland schools, and we're gonna throw them out the next time around. But kind of in the larger sense, like California is just underfunding education and has been for decades, and that needs to change. And we have a lot of strength that has been built, and a lot of organization, and a lot of passion. And we have a bunch of different groups who are organizing. It's not just teachers; it's community members, it's students. You know, they're linking up. They're gonna make some moves on the state capitol. Essentially, we're going to go to Sacramento. We're going to demand that that we get the funding that we need. We're going to demand charter moratoriums, and we're going to make sure that the Prop 13 reform, the Schools and Communities First Act, passes in 2020.
And we should mention, because you brought up charters again, because of the strike, the school board will vote on a resolution calling on the state to stop charter growth in OUSD. OUSD charter schools drain the district of about $57 million a year, according to one key study, howmuchcharterscost.org. Do you know when this vote will be happening?
I don't know when that vote is, and in fact, I didn't know that the school board was going to be actually voting on that resolution, so that will be interesting to see which way it goes.
Yeah, this is from a release I just got from the Oakland Education Association, so we will continue to follow that. We're going to definitely do a show about education funding in California, and we'd love to have teachers on, so we will be in touch again. Alex, thanks again for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Alex Webster-Guiney has been a special education teacher with the Oakland Unified School District for 4 years. The Oakland teacher strike ended on Monday. 58% of Oakland educators voted to ratify a deal with the district. Alex said she voted no over salary, bloated paychecks, school closures, and then future bargaining. And we will definitely continue to cover this story. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. We're going to take a quick break, and coming up, we're going to talk about Nevertheless, a new show that draws its name from the feminist rallying cry, Nevertheless, She Persisted. It combines song and dance, guerrilla installations, and comedy to call attention to gender-based harassment. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Remember when Senator Mitch McConnell cut off Senator Elizabeth Warren when she was reading a letter by Coretta Scott King about Attorney General nominee Jeff Sessions? Mitch McConnell said, quote, "She was warned. She was given an explanation. Nevertheless, she persisted," end quote. Well, "Nevertheless, She Persisted" has been turned into a feminist rallying cry. It's also been turned into a dance performance by the performing arts ensemble Kanasi, a collective with music by the Catcall Choir. In the performance, which debuts tonight in San Francisco, artists tackle gender-based harassment with song and dance, comedy, and horror. It features 25 singers and dancers performing 17 vignettes exploring gender discrimination, harassment, and sexual violence. Nevertheless, we'll also include a companion gallery installation from Bay Area and national artists who explore similar themes in their work. Joining us to talk about how creative expression challenges harassment are three guests. Tanya Kanasi is a choreographer and founder and artistic director of the performing arts ensemble Kanasi Collective. And Tanya joins us in studio. Hi, Tanya. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. We're also joined by Allison Buganim, a sculptor. I wanted to get that right. Her project, Wax That Ass, is a series of interactive butt sculptures that combat and comment on sexual harassment. The sculptures, which are made out of actual women's butts, incorporate technology and have buttons and sensors that once touched project different sounds and phrases. Hi, Allison. Thank you for joining us.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Heather Arnett, director of the Catcall Choir, which sets real catcalls and commentary to the tunes of children's rhymes and other well-known songs. Heather created the Catcall Choir to use humor and storytelling to combat the anger and the frustration that so many of us experience when we are harassed. Heather, nice to see you. Thank you for coming in.
Hi, Rose. Thank you.
Great to have all of you. All of their work will be featured in Nevertheless, which runs for 4 performances at Z Space in San Francisco, Thursday, March 7th, March 8th, March 9th at 8 p.m. That's Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, and then a matinee on Sunday. at 2 p.m. The gallery installation is open 2 hours prior to every performance and is free to the public. Nevertheless, we'll also be at Counterpulse April 19th through the 22nd in San Francisco. Is that right? I saw that on the website.
That was actually last year.
Last year. I did not see the year. Okay. Thank you. So this one is just at Z Space Thursday through Sunday, and I hope you can make it. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. I want to start off by asking you all, just on a personal level, how you have been affected by Me Too. I mean, it's still happening. I was just reading about Ryan Adams, the musician who has been accused of sexual harassment, and he just canceled, I believe it's his European tour. So this just, I was reading about the New York Ballet in New York. It just continues to happen. I just wonder how you have all been affected by that personally. Tanya, let's start off with you.
Well, we began this process in 2016 before the hashtag MeToo movement got that big wave of attention. It's been around for a while, but so it was really interesting to be in this process, thinking about this every day, doing a lot of research, talking in rehearsals, and then for all of this to come to the forefront of our conversation in this country and everybody talking about this. So because I've been thinking almost nonstop about this topic for 2 years, two and a half years, I'm not necessarily surprised by anything. It's just sort of a continuation, which is really difficult, but here we are. But I'm so thankful that the conversation is at the forefront of all of our minds.
Allison, what would you add?
Yeah, I think that the conversations that are being had and brought to everyone's attention are so powerful, and the fact that we can all come together and acknowledge that I think that, like, harassment in some form is, like, a universally, like, woman's issue, and that we've all experienced some spectrum of it. And so the fact that we can all come together and recognize that we have this shared experience, and finally we can talk about how it's not okay, and accepting it as our, like, new normal, and addressing that it's finally time to stop accepting this.
I mean, in many ways, you just reminded me, Tanya, that it's hard to even keep up, because I mentioned Ryan Adams and the New York Ballet, and then there was that R. Kelly interview where he got up and started yelling during an interview with Gayle King. So it's hard to actually keep up with how fast this is moving. What would you add, Heather? How has this all affected you?
I really appreciate how the Me Too wave has demonstrated that critical mass catalyzes change, and that if you want something to happen, you also have to be a part of it. And we were talking just prior to this interview about how so many different people now feel comfortable sharing their stories, and that they themselves can't even explain why that they feel comfortable. And I think it is that critical mass, the attention that's being drawn, that says, okay, this is, I now have the freedom to also share my story.
Right. And I was telling you, all of you, about the broadcast we did during the Kavanaugh hearings. And when they took a break, we opened the lines and heard from so many people, mostly older women, who'd never told their stories before. We also heard from an older man who never told his story before. And you've got incredible stories about what you have heard as a result of this performance. But before we talk about that, you all do really incredible work. And I just want to get a little bit of background about your work, what really inspires you. So Tanya, you are choreographer and founder of the Kanasi Ensemble. Tell us a little bit about that collective and what really inspires your work.
Sure. Everything that we work on and create and present is surrounding an idea of perspective. The odd name of the company is Kanasi Collective, and the first word is a play on the words, can I see, as in what am I looking at, and also my strange Italian last name. And so all of our work brings attention to some, I don't want to say issue, but something, and then hopefully changes our awareness around that topic. So for example, we recently did a show about Marcel Duchamp, the Dada artist who used to take works at the turn of the century and take various everyday items, turn them on their side, put them in an art gallery and say, this is no longer, for example, his famous work, The Urinal, titled Fountain, but instead this entirely different item. So we took hundreds and hundreds of rolls of toilet paper and used that as scenery and costumes and never addressed it as toilet paper, but instead as this billowy item that could be used for all these different mediums. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so with this work, we started, we just 2 years ago started making work about this topic to bring awareness, and here we are.
And Allison, tell us about your project, Wax That Ass. I was reading a piece about the installation in the Miami Times, and in that piece you said that your experiences growing up in Miami inspired you to create the butts.
Yep, absolutely. So the series was inspired by exactly growing up in Miami and from a very young age experiencing some form of harassment or being catcalled. And me accepting that as, like, the way of life. I didn't know that life could be different. I didn't know that people weren't supposed to yell at you on the street or supposed to follow you on your way to school or supposed to be so kind of aggressive like that. I thought that was just the way things were supposed to be. And then just being very observant and just, like, how many strip clubs it took to get to school in my daily routine, or just how many how often women's bodies were sexualized, and that was just, like, the default. And growing up that way, it was, like, very challenging because I didn't know how to challenge it because I didn't know there was another way, but it was also something just so powerful inside of me that was, like, I don't want to accept this anymore. I can't accept this. There has to be an alternative. And so that really started the series and me just wanting to kind of fight back the kind of pressures and patriarchy, whatever, like that was put onto us as being women and being seen as just only as sexual bodies or forms as a means to sell things versus the women, the powerful, beautiful bodies that we really are in our minds and attached to it.
It's a very powerful image to think of you as a high school student walking past five or six strip clubs. Were they open while you were walking past?
Yeah, you'd be surprised how many people go to strip clubs at like 3 p.m. Strip clubs were open, just also just like random signage and like vans. You know how like vans have like blinking advertisement at like just broad daylight in the afternoon, like advertising these strip clubs and other areas like that.
What about you? Tell us a little bit more about the Cat Call Collective.
Cat Call Choir started as a result of
Cat Call Choir.
The need for a more productive response to street harassment. I started documenting just personal cases of harassment in about 2014, and I started doing that just to, I think, prove to myself that it was as bad as I thought it was. And unfortunately, in the documentation, I just started feeling worse, and it made me angrier. I found myself going out looking to be harassed and then, you know, angrily scribbling something down. Wow. And I needed to do something different. And so I took all of the quotes that I had written down, and I created a song to the tune of Brahms' Lullaby, which we now call Lick You Lullaby. So that was the first Cat Call Choir song, and it is comprised of nothing more than quotes from street harassment. And I started singing that song just on the street in the Mission District by myself, and tried to get people to listen, and a few folks would stop and have conversations with me about what I was singing about. And so that's sort of the origin story. And then I got a few women to join me and do a small performance, and it's just magically created itself from that point.
Wow. Heather Arnett is director of the Cat Call Choir, which sets real cat calls and commentary to the tunes of children's rhymes and other well-known songs. Allison Bouganim is a sculptor. Her project, Wax That Ass, is a series of interactive butt sculptures that combat and comment on sexual harassment. And Tanya Kanasi is a choreographer and the founder and artistic director of the performing arts ensemble Kanasi Collective. All of their work will be featured in Nevertheless, which runs for four performances at Z Space in San Francisco tonight, Friday night, and Saturday night, 8:00, with a matinee on Sunday at 2:00. There will be a gallery installation open 2 hours prior to every performance, and you can find information at yourcallradio.org. This is Your Call. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back after this.
El Chapo's new prison must be special, a facility from which there is no escape. That's why the convicted drug lord will likely spend the rest of his days in Colorado, home to the country's best-known supermax prison. They call it the Alcatraz of the Rockies. What's it like behind those bars? Next time on 1A.
You can hear 1A with Joshua Johnson at 11 o'clock, 1/2 hour from now, here on 91.7. There are many ways you can take part in the conversation on Your Call, on the phone, by sending an email to yourcall@klw.org, or by going to the yourcallradio.org website. If you'd like to participate in today's show by telephone, call toll-free 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. You can also tweet us at Your Call Radio.
This is Your Call. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We will discuss coverage of the campaign against Representative Ilhan Omar for criticizing the political influence of the pro-Israel lobby AIPAC. The House Democrats are having a debate over anti-Semitism and Islamophobia. And then we will hear about a 9-month Mother Jones investigation about how recovering addicts are being wooed by patient brokers and rehabs to fill beds and collect insurance money. It's really a shocking investigation, and we hope you can join us for that tomorrow. If you have a guest idea or a show idea, you can send us an email, yourcall@kalw.org. Today we are talking about a new performance called Nevertheless, which was inspired by Mitch McConnell when he cut off Senator Elizabeth Warren when she was reading a letter by Coretta Scott King about Attorney General nominee Jeff Sessions. He said, quote, "She was warned. She was given an explanation. Nevertheless, she persisted," end quote. You can see Nevertheless Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at Z-Space in San Francisco at 8 o'clock. There's a matinee on Sunday at 2 p.m. There will be a gallery installation open 2 hours prior to every performance. And today we're speaking with Tanya Kanasi, choreographer and founder and artistic director of the performing arts ensemble Kanasi Collective. Allison Buganim is a sculptor. Her project Wax That Ass is a series of butt sculptures that combat and comment on sexual harassment. And Heather Arnett is director of the Cat Call Choir, which sets real cat calls and commentary to the tune of children's rhymes and other well-known songs. If you'd like to join us, what are your thoughts about where we are with Me Too and sexual harassment? And if you have any comments about how creative expression challenges harassment, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Tanya, how did you all come together to work on this performance and the art installation?
After the election in 2016, I personally wasn't sure how to process my thoughts. So I got together with some of my collaborators and we started making work surrounding the idea of unsolicited touching. And I was interested in the juxtaposition of sort of feminine flowy movement while these performers were grossly grabbing each other and how that makes you feel if you're watching this. These women do this to themselves or to each other. We started presenting that publicly and got a lot of great response. So we started making more work about various things, at which point Heather, who I've known for many years and have danced with together in other projects throughout the city, reached out to me and said, hey, you know, you saw Catcall Choir when I started it. And what do you think about collaborating? So at that point, we got together and started working on the first iteration of Nevertheless, which premiered last April and was a combination of both of our companies. And then we got so much positive and intense response from that show, from audience members saying, I want to see it again. I want to bring more people. I want to be involved, including Allison, who's here with us today. And we were like, of course, let's do this. Let's create an art gallery show. This beautiful new venue that we're in has a giant lobby that's just stunning. So let's offer this space to other artists and make more opportunities. So we set up a call for artists all over the country. We got a lot of applications, and now there are 8 visual artists who are presenting work about gender-based harassment in the lobby of Z Space before our show, Nevertheless.
Allison, what was your response when you saw Nevertheless?
I thought it was so powerful. I first saw the Cat Call Choir installment. I was coming home from BART, and I was leaving from Civic Center BART station, and I ran into Heather and her group, and they were doing like a guerrilla performance at Civic Center, and I thought it was so powerful, and so I immediately reached out to her. And then I saw the show afterwards, and I just thought that the incorporation of not just the Cat Call Choir, but Kanisi Collective and movement and performance, and it was just so powerful. There were moments where I was laughing. There were moments where I was crying. There's so many emotions in such a small, jam-packed amount of time. It was incredible.
What about you, Heather? The Cat Call Choir is in the performance, but what was it like for you to actually sit in the audience and watch the performance?
I didn't.
Oh, you didn't?
The first time around, I was performing.
You were performing.
And so it was so difficult to step out and be like, what does this look like, Tanya? And then jump back on stage and sing again. And so this time around, we decided that it was best for me to step out and be in the director's role. And although I'm really sad about not being able to be performing in this show, I'm so happy to be able to see it.
So what is that like for you in that different position, in that angle?
It's very exciting to watch the things that you, as a performer, that you feel manifest in other people. And while every performer has their own interpretation of a song or a feeling or a movement, we all share this through line of, in this particular show, intensity that comes from this demanding embracing of vulnerability. And I'm just grateful to all the performers for putting themselves in that position to accept that responsibility to say, if I'm going to be in this show, then I also have to make myself vulnerable to the audience. And so just watching them authentically go through their experience of the show is what's been most enjoyable for me.
As the person who was the sort of main director and stood back last time and watched every single night and watched that transformation, it's an incredibly difficult thing to both ask your performers to put mm-hmm. themselves through that every night and ask your audience to sit through it. Mm-hmm. Because throughout the whole performance, these dancers and singers are both the victims and the harassers at various times. And so we've had to do a lot of self-care and a lot of mm-hmm. taking care of each other. But nonetheless, as Allison said, we've gotten great feedback about it being such an accessible show because it incorporates humor in a way that brings us all in together. We're all cracking up, and then it kind of flips on its head many times throughout the show and goes, but really what we're talking about is this horrible thing. Isn't that interesting? Like, if you actually think about that, isn't that really gross? What can we do about this? Mm-hmm.
Hmm. What has the experience been like for the performers? I understand that you asked all of the dancers, all women, what is the most vivid, memorable sexual harassment or discrimination experience you have personally gone through?
Yeah, we asked many questions like that throughout the process that they had to both write about privately and then share if they wanted or not. And then we also did a lot of talking about so many more topics and generating movement and lyrics, et cetera, to create the show. So it's a very vulnerable thing in process. But we've gotten a staggering amount of response from individuals participating in this project saying that it was very therapeutic for them to be able to feel like they were actually making a difference, and also so they could personally address their own experiences and think about that and how they can move forward.
How did these discussions really shape the overall performance?
I mean, that's the heart of the performance. It is. We work really hard on not speaking for all women mm-hmm. in this show. We are only telling the stories of those personally involved. So those individual stories from everybody is the heart of this show, their real life stories.
And it continues to feed the performance. I mean, we'll do a run and then have notes, and the performers will then report back to us and say, you know how we were doing this one thing during this part? We don't feel like it's that anymore. We feel like it's much more subtly aggressive, and it's not quite so violent. And then we'll just say, fine, run with that idea if that's what it has become for you.
Let's hear from a caller. Let's go to Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Hello. I guess what I was thinking as you were talking that this kind of issue and something like a climate change needs more exposure, and I'm wondering how your guests feel they can get more exposure than what they're doing already, because you're going to be reaching a small audience. How can this get to a larger audience? And I just had an idea, which is really bizarre, but I don't know how this would work. Public television, I don't know if there's any way to even just get like a small trailer in front. Sexual harassment is against the law, it's immoral, whatever. Or the climate crisis is a crisis, you know. And if these things were constantly being fed to people in some way, I don't know, that's the way it seems to me you can get to a larger audience. I don't know if they've thought about this or if there's anything that they can do to get it to a larger audience.
Well, first of all, Greg, are you for hire?
I think we lost Greg. Greg's one of our favorites.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, I want to put him on my staff right now.
I think that would be a great idea. Definitely not up our alley. What we're trying to do with our show specifically is bring people into this space where they get these moments where they actually, regardless of their experiences, their gender, how they identify, et cetera, they get those experiences of what it actually feels like to be followed home at night and what it feels like to have somebody touch you for 5 minutes or graze your thigh on public transit, et cetera.
And I think that's why live performance is so powerful, is because you feel it viscerally in a way that you just don't feel other things.
Hmm. Well, and to Greg's point about how to publicize this, Allison, when I visited your website and looked at the Wax That Ass and the butt sculptures, I just started laughing out loud because you've got these butts in front of the Google, what is this thing? Their
logo.
And it's in front of their office, I think, with the Bay Bridge in the background. You've got these butts in front of an Uber sign.
Yeah.
I mean, this is brilliant. You have them at BART. You have them right in front of Civic Center, in front of City Hall, on top of laundry. Yeah. I mean, it's incredible to have those out there in just this space. So first of all, just to describe this to our listeners, so these are butt sculptures, and they were made from actual women's butts.
Correct.
Right?
Yep.
And so they basically, it's the butt with like the very top of the leg.
Yep.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So then what happened? What do they do? What happens when you've got a couple buttons on them?
Yep. So each sculpture has buttons or sensors on the sculpture itself. And I work with the women to really understand like what kind of interaction they want to portray. And so it's very like hands-on with the women that I actually mold. And so when you press certain buttons on the sculptures, you hear audio recordings from the actual women, and they are sharing their stories of harassment. And so that can be anything from describing what has happened to them or their response to what has happened or direct quotes from things that have been said to them. And each sculpture has 5 or 6 buttons on them, and each button is pre-recorded with up to 10 phrases. And so every time you press a button, a different phrase will emerge, and each sculpture is tailored specifically to the woman herself. And so she is literally sharing her story in a way that kind of can't be ignored, and especially when I take them out and have site-specific installations in the places specifically where they have personally been harassed, just calling attention to the fact that harassment it's not something that you wear that brings harassment. It's not a specific place you go to where you're expecting kind of harassment. It's these everyday places that women all over are getting constantly harassed at or have personal experience being harassed at, and bringing attention to the fact that it happens everywhere to every woman and
Can you tell us what some of the messages are when you hit the button? None of the swear words, because we're on radio.
Not. We're on the public radio.
Yes.
So some of them are like, come over here and sit on my lap. There was a woman who was talking to me about her experience at university, and there was a man who came to her sorority with a gun, actually, and hated sorority women and women in general, and started shouting, saying women belong in internment camps. And he actually murdered sorority girls that night.
When did this happen?
I think it was 10 years ago. UC Santa Barbara.
Oh, okay. Wow.
And she was one of the sorority girls that Luckily, she wasn't hurt, but because they locked the doors, but that man went to a different sorority that had the door open and brutally hurt women. And so it goes from really intense experiences, like almost being murdered because you're a woman, to just walking home and feeling unsafe. And and then there's one sculpture specifically where it has kind of the same thing, but in the workplace environment. And so, like, just being a woman existing in the workplace, or being a mother, or all those other things.
What response? I'm sure that there have been times when you stand away from the sculptures just to see how people react to it. What really stands out for you when you think about those responses?
Oh, man, my favorite part is, like, people watching while these sculptures live in places and just watching people's reactions. It's pretty mixed. It's actually really hilarious to me that whenever I have these sculptures, women, I notice, are more willing to come up to them and interact with them and aren't very scared to press the buttons and hear the phrases. And men are usually the ones that, like, are looking around and, like, is it okay if I touch here? You touched here, so I can touch here. Wait, who's looking at me? Like, what's going on? Is this a prank? What's happening? And that's the complete opposite in real life. And so it's just so funny that in this context, men are, like, super hyper aware of the people watching them interact with these things, where women are more willing to just go for it.
Can you all talk about the power of interactive art and how it's taking on this issue? There's a video going around Twitter of a woman, I believe it's in New York City, and she has this really cool one piece on, and it's skin tight. And she's standing there in the train, and this guy slaps her in the behind, and she just goes after him. And he says, well, look what you're wearing. Now, some people say it was staged just to show people what women have to go through. I have no idea if it was, but this happens a lot. It's getting a lot of reaction because one person does stick up for the woman, saying, you can't do that. Mm. And he said, but look what she's wearing. And he said it doesn't matter. So can you talk about just the power of this kind of art and how it's, you know, getting people to respond? And thanks to social media, it's spreading like wildfire.
Well, we have a whole section on this show that's about shaming, specifically about what you're wearing. And it's set to Cell Block Tango music from Chicago, the musical Chicago. And the lyrics that the Catcall Choir is singing is along the lines of, I betcha you would have shamed the same. And they're telling all these stories. And at the same time, the dancers, while the Catcall Choir is singing, they're being dressed. And the clothes go from what we typically, quote-unquote, think of as provocative to more ridiculous outfits, including ski masks and giant onesies and hard hats.
Galoshes.
And all these different outfits, and going, you know, it really doesn't actually matter what you're wearing. If you're going to be harassed, you're going to be harassed anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've told a lot of stories during that process about various times we have been shamed about what we're wearing.
Mm-hmm. There's a Catcall Choir song called Heart Your Parts, and it's set to Mary Had a Little Lamb. And it too describes the myth that it actually matters what you're wearing and that it's your fault for choosing to be harassed by wearing something specific.
I also think it's, like, the power of public intervention, having, like, these interactive pieces or anything like that in, like, a public space. And so having these very visible conversations and just, like, reflections with yourself, while also, in my case, like, understanding that you're being watched, and that there is, like, not only are these pieces for you to interact with, but you are the subject of these pieces' gaze. And you, as interacting with them, are a part of the art now. And that experience.
Can people see the butts today? Are they out in around the Bay Area?
They're not. So there's site-specific gorilla installations around the city, which basically means that I don't have permission to have them there. And so they last as long as until somebody tells me to leave.
But they are on display this weekend at the art gallery that will be
at Z-Space.
At Z-Space. Again, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at 8 p.m. That's Z-Space in San Francisco. There's a matinee on Sunday at 2 o'clock, and the gallery installation is open 2 hours before every performance. We're almost out of time. This went by so fast. Tanya, are there any other art installations that you'd like to give us a preview of? Anything that stands out? I'm sure they all do, but a couple that stand out.
Yeah, well, the three of us here today, plus a woman named Sari Rudin, were the curators of the art gallery. And Sari is from Detroit. She just flew in yesterday. And she makes work about actual text messages or messages that happen in online dating apps. So the harassment that happens through online dating. And then she turns them into these gorgeous graphic design, you know, posters and canvases that just takes these things that are actually said to her and turns them into something else. And now she's gotten actually, she has thousands of followers and people send her their actual screenshots of their experiences and she turns them into work. So her work is called Sarey Tales, S-A-R-E-Y, and then Tales. And so she has a lot, I mean, I'd say a good 25 pieces in the gallery.
Yeah. And what's so powerful about those pieces is that not only do you see the final product of this like really well-designed poster, but you also see a direct quote and like screenshots from the actual messages. So it's like these aren't embellished. The people are actually this awful. And here's the proof.
And then the most hilarious thing, I think, is that Sarey doesn't sign the pieces. She puts, or if she does this very discreet, she puts the first name of the harasser and then the date. So like James, 2018.
I can only imagine. And Heather, I just wanted to ask you, catcall choir, for people who, men, for example, who have never experienced being catcalled, when you talk to women, how often does this happen still today?
Daily.
Yeah.
Daily for most women. Yeah. And it's hard for, it has much more to do with the power dynamic between, that exists between men and women, from simply the physiological perspective of being stronger and bigger for the most part, to the positions that they often hold over women, in the workplace, et cetera. And so it's very difficult for them to understand, understandably. And so what I'm hoping that this work does is encourage them to hear what they're saying. So one of Catcall Choir's artistic restrictions is that we do not admonish, we do not correct, and we do not talk about our feelings. We simply retell the story with flair and innuendo and then let the story speak for itself. I want it to be putting a mirror up in front of them so they can see it and hear it and feel it in the way, in the exact way, well, close enough, that we receive it and hope that that message lands.
Well, I hope if you are in the area, you can see Nevertheless tonight, tomorrow, and Saturday at 8 p.m. There's a matinee on Sunday at 2 p.m. at Z-Space in San Francisco. The gallery installation will be open 2 hours prior to every performance. Heather Arnett is director of the Catcall Choir, which sets real catcalls and commentary to the tunes of children's rhymes and other well-known songs. Allison Bouganim is a sculptor. Her project, Wax That Ass, is a series of interactive butt sculptures that combat and comment on sexual harassment. And Tanya Kinesi is a choreographer and the founder and artistic director of the performing arts ensemble Kinesi Collective. Tanya, Allison, and Heather, thank you so much for your amazing work and thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. And you can find more information about Nevertheless at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Laura Wenis for producing today's show and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.